good to see a really good crowd out this morning. It's really encouraging, and we have lots of visitors with us, and we just want to let you know that we're really excited that you've chosen to worship with us. In the college class a few minutes ago, we were talking about 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and to that church, he mentions the Lord Jesus, who is their Lord and ours, talking about other Christians and other places, and so it's just really encouraging to be with you and to worship your Lord and ours, who's Jesus Christ. We have people from other places who are traveling, and we're thankful that you've stopped, and we even have people from the community, and we're just really grateful that you've chosen to be with us and hope that you'll come back. You've definitely been an encouragement. You can open your Bibles to Genesis 32. Genesis chapter 32, and really the lesson will be coming from chapters 32 and 33. I'm getting to the end of a study that I've been doing with Katie and Ryan and Amanda Smith and Jacob Smithson and Avery Reed. Just people have kind of come and gone. But we've gone almost all the way through the book of Genesis. And really what stood out to me is that Genesis is just this really sad, pathetic story of the failures of the family God chose. I mean, like, when you hear about Abraham, and you hear about Isaac, and you hear about Jacob in your Bible classes growing up, you think that, like, man, they're just these flawless pillars of faith. And they are pillars of faith. Hebrews 11 exalts them as such, but you read about their stories in Genesis, and they're so flawed. And they make so many mistakes, and really, they're so relatable to us. But when you get to chapters 32 and 33 in Genesis, you get to the really climax of Jacob's story. And I just want to set a little context here about Jacob and Esau. I'm sure most of you know who Jacob and Esau are and sort of their relationship. But back in chapter 25, when Jacob was born, he came out as a twin with Esau, and he was holding Esau's heel. And in chapter 25 and verse 23 begins to tell this story. And it says that the older would serve the younger. But Jacob's name was given to him because Jacob's name means heel grabber. And that's just sort of the way Jacob was throughout life, is he was trying to cheat people, and he was trying to steal from Jacob, and it doesn't from Esau. And it doesn't take him very long to really get to doing that. We read in verse 27 that when the boys grew up, Esau was the favorite of his father, but Isaac loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. But then as we look at verses 29 through 34, there's a very familiar story where Esau, as the older son, has this birthright, and he comes in from the field, and Jacob is cooking a pot of stew, lentils, which apparently Jacob was pretty good at, and Esau was asking for some food, and Jacob says, yeah, I'll give you the food if you give me your birthright, which, I mean, I don't know if he was serious about that or not, but Esau said, sure. And so, like, in that story, both of them are sort of at fault. But there wasn't just this birthright, there was also a blessing. And we read about that as we look in chapter 27. In chapter 27, there's just this story of just how broken and messed up this family is, that it's terrible. Isaac, the father, is old and he's blind, and his favorite, remember, is Esau. And he says, Esau, I'm really sorry that Jacob stole this birthright thing from you, but I can still give you this blessing. So here's what you need to do. Go out to the field and hunt, and then make some food for me and bring it back, and then I'll bless you. And Rebekah, the mother, overhears this plan. And she says, Jacob, come here, and I've got this idea. And she takes like some goat skin and puts it on Jacob's arms so that he feels hairy like Esau. And he goes in to his blind father and steals the blessing from his brother. It's like, man, that is so messed up. You think Esau would be pretty mad about that, and he is. Look at Esau's reaction in chapter 27 and verse 41. It says, now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to him, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." And so, like, things escalate really quick because Esau realizes Jacob has cheated him twice, out of first the birthright and then out of the blessing. And so Jacob flees and he goes to his uncle Laban and he runs to him so that he can have some safety from Esau. And he runs and he goes and works for his uncle for 20 years. 2 decades pass. And after those 20 years, Jacob has sort of double-crossed Laban, and Laban has sort of double-crossed Jacob, and these two guys really deserve each other. I mean, they're just constantly just double-crossing each other. They're slimy-type characters, it seems like. And so Jacob makes a mess of where he ends up working for Laban, so he has to leave there too, and he is caught between the proverbial rock and the hard place. I mean, he's got Laban on his back, and now Esau at his front. And so in chapter 32, this long-awaited reunion of Jacob and Esau is beginning to happen. Look at verse 3. This is how Jacob begins to prepare for this meeting. "And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, 'Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male servants, and female servants. I have sent to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight.'" Okay, so that's ancient Hebrew for "I'm not going to rob you," is what Jacob is wanting to communicate there. It's like, "I know, Esau, that I have stolen from you in the past, but just be aware, I've got plenty of stuff now. I don't need to steal anything else from you." And so he's sort of lifting that up so Esau doesn't think that he's going to grab his heel again and be a Jacob again. But then, listen to the message that comes back to Jacob in verse 6. "The messengers returned to Jacob saying, 'We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him.'" Okay. Panic would really start to set in at that point. I mean, Jacob had wronged his brother Esau. The last words that he had heard from Esau was, "Esau's going to kill me. Like, that's what I can expect." And now, after 20 years, the fury hasn't subsided. Like, the grudge, he's not buried any hatchets. There's 400 hatchets coming in the hands of these people that are with him. This is a really terrifying type scene that's approaching. So Jacob's first response is to scheme and to just sort of plan. So verse 7, "Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, as you might imagine. He divided the people who were with him and the flocks and the herds and camels into two camps, thinking, 'If Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape.'" Okay, so, I mean, Jacob is just decided at this point, "I'll sacrifice 50%, you know? I'm not going to carry all my eggs in one basket. I'll divide up everything I have. That way, when Esau attacks, he doesn't get everything. He just gets half of it." And then Jacob prays to God in verses 9 through 12. And really, it's a good prayer. We're going to have to hurry through some of this. But he appeals to God's promises. In verse 12, he says, "You said, 'I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.'" And so, just as a side note, if we're going to pray to God and we're going to ask Him for things, it's generally a good thing to remind God of what He's promised us. You know, if we're going to pray to God, we can say, "God, you have said this. Now, please be with me." So Jacob prays to God, but then look at what he does next. Verse 13. "So he stayed there that night, and from what he had with him, he took a present for his brother Esau. 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their calves, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. These he handed over to his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, 'Pass on ahead of me and put a space between drove and drove.' He instructed the first, "When Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, 'To whom do you belong? Where are you going? And whose are these ahead of you?' Then you shall say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. They are a present sent to my lord Esau. And moreover, he is behind us.'" He likewise instructed the second and the third and all who followed the droves, "You shall say the same thing to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, 'Moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us.' For he thought, 'I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me, and afterward I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me.' So the present passed on ahead of him, and he himself stayed that night in the camp." So what you see in Jacob is that there's just this tone of desperation. And meeting Esau is just a really scary proposition. To see the face of Esau, knowing that he has the right to just kill me on sight, is scary, and Jacob's desperate. And so, like, what I think is happening with his plan here is, first of all, he's micromanaging what everybody says to Esau. He doesn't want anything to go wrong here. But each company is going to approach Esau, and Esau's going to think that's the whole company, and they're going to say, "Hey, Jacob's right behind us." But it's not going to be Jacob. It's going to be another company of gifts. And then they're going to say, "Hey, Jacob's right behind us." But it's not Jacob. It's another company of gifts. And finally, when all of that's exhausted, when all of the gifts are ahead of him, then Jacob thinks maybe Esau will be appeased and I can meet him. And that's the scene here. So Jacob goes to bed that night. And something very, very strange happens. Let's keep reading here in verse 22. "The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had, and Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, 'Let me go, for the day is broken.' But Jacob said, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.' And he said to him, 'What is your name?' And he said, 'Jacob.' Then he said, 'Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed.' Then Jacob asked him, 'Please tell me your name.' But he said, 'Why is it that you ask my name?' And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, 'For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered.' The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of his thigh." So this is really a bizarre encounter that, quite honestly, people have wrestled with ever since it was written. Like, what's going on here? What's the point? What's this mean? But I just want you to put yourself in Jacob's shoes for a second. You know, like, you're camped at night, terrified that your brother Esau is going to come, and suddenly this figure starts to emerge in the darkness. I mean, he probably thought, like, this is it. Esau's found me. This is where I die. He's finally come to assassinate me. Maybe he's found me. And so there's this wrestling match that happens, alone and in the dark. And soon he finds out that this is not Esau. And soon he finds out that this isn't even really a normal man at all. It says in this passage that the one he wrestled with touched his hip, and his hip went out of socket. The Greek Hebrew word literally means like touched, not like, you know, punched. And a hip's not the easiest thing to throw out of socket. I actually did throw my hip out of socket one time, believe it or not. I was trying out for baseball and I was running a sprint, and all of a sudden it felt like a firecracker went off in my hip, and I was crippled for weeks. So I know Jacob's pain here. And what's amazing to me is that Jacob's hip is thrown out of socket, and he doesn't just say, like, okay, fine, I'm done, I'm beaten, I give up. He holds on, and he holds on, and the sun is starting to come up. And this figure asks him, "What's your name?" And he says, "My name's Jacob." And he says, "It's not going to be Jacob anymore. It's going to be Israel, because you've striven with God and with man, and you've prevailed." And Jacob says, "Well, what's your name?" And he says, "I think you know that." This is God that Jacob is wrestling with. And in the struggle, Jacob learned the spirit that he shows in verse 26, that Jacob says, "I will not let you go until you bless me." And I think it's because he learned that God said, "You've won. You've wrestled with me and you've learned this lesson, not to let me go until I give you a blessing." We're going to come back to this story and try to make a little sense of it. But the resolution of the story happens in chapter 33. So after this very strange encounter in the night, Jacob wakes up the next morning. In verse 1, it says that Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked. And behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two female servants. He put the servants with their children in front, then Leah with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. He himself went out before them, bowing himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. And so at this point, like, every resource has been exhausted. Everything he could put between himself and Jacob has been put there. It's just Jacob and Esau. Look at 4a. It says, "But Esau ran to meet him." Stop there. I mean, I think Jacob would have been terrified, you know, as he sees Esau just running towards him and thinking, like, this is it. This is it. But the rest of the verse says that he ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And when Esau lifted up his eyes and saw the women and children, he said, "Who are these with you?" And Jacob said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." Then the servants drew near, they and their children, and they bowed down. Leah likewise and her children drew near and bowed down. And last, Joseph and Rachel drew near and they bowed down. And Esau said, "What do you mean by all this company that I met?" Jacob answered, "To find favor in the sight of my Lord." But Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." Jacob said, "No, please, if I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand. For I've seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. Please accept my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." Thus he urged him, and he took it. And man, this scene is just spectacular. Christopher Nolan or Steven Spielberg couldn't write anything just so, like, touching as this. That here comes Esau running out to meet Jacob, and he realizes that his cry is not like this blood cry, but it's a cry of, like, excitement. And he's not coming out with a sword or a spear, but with an embrace. And they meet, and they share this moment, and Esau's like, "I haven't seen you in 20 years. Tell me about your family." And it's just really a happy, tender ending to the story. But our question this morning is, what's it mean? What's the point here for us? What are we seeing here? And I'll submit to you that what we're seeing here is a lot. And if you're still with me, it's going to pay off. That you're going to see that what we're seeing here is beautiful and it's profound, and it's a picture of really the gospel. First of all, let me just point this out. In verse 4, when Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him and they wept, does that remind you of anything in the Bible? You know, that string of phrases, ran out to meet him, embraced him, fell on his neck, kissed him, is only found one other place in the Bible. It's in the parable of the prodigal son. And in the prodigal son, the one that runs out to the son and embraces him and meets him and kisses him and falls on his neck and all that, that's the father. And he represents God. So when we look at this story in Genesis, the shocking thing that we find out is that Esau represents God. Esau is actually the God figure that is being presented in this story. And Jacob makes this strange statement in verse 10 that I think confirms that. In verse 10, Jacob says, "If I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand, for I have seen your face," which is like seeing the face of God. That's weird. Like, what did he mean by that? But I think that what that does is it points us to seeing ourselves in this story. And it points us to seeing that this story shows us our relationship with God. And so I just want to talk for a few minutes about what seeing the face of God is like. And the first thing that I think that we should just admit is that seeing the face of God is really a terrifying proposition. If you don't believe that, read the prophets. And go back to our minor prophet study. All these instances of God coming down to visit people and to see people, normally that's a terrifying proposition, especially when we know that we've wronged God. Especially when we know that we've done something where God could give us justice and that he could really just kill us. And so what's happening in the story is that Esau shows up with 400 people with him. But we're not talking about Esau with 400. We're talking about the Lord of hosts, you know, with like millions of angelic forces around him and armies around him. So here's what happens to us. This is where it starts to fit in with our life, is that when we know that we have wronged God, when we know that we have angered him, when we know that we've sinned and fallen short, a lot of times what we do is we just decide we're going to go work for Laban. You know? We're going to go work for Laban. We're just going to get away from God. We're just going to try to avoid him. And, I mean, there's a lot of people in this world who are just consumed and defined by working for Laban. You work for your boss. You work for the goals of this world. You work for your first wife. You work for your second wife. Maybe it doesn't exactly add up to Jacob's story, but after you get your wife situation taken care of, you know, you want to get flocks, you want to get sheep, you want to get herds. And the way working for Laban works is normally you don't set out to do it for 20 years. You set out to just do it for 7. It's like, I'm just going to focus on this for a certain amount of time, and I'm going to make this my goal and this my aim. And then after I get that, then maybe I can make my life right with God. But you achieve one thing and then you want the next, and then you achieve something else, and there's something else to keep working for, and 7 years become 14, and 14 become 20, and 20 become 60, and then you're an old man lying in your bed and you've wasted it all. You've missed it all. And there's an inherent problem with that approach, is that as long as we avoid meeting God and seeing his face and reconciling, maybe by some reason of strength, you can make it to 70 or 80, but there is an inevitable meeting with God. You know, like one day, Esau is going to come back. One day, you're going to have to see his face. One day, you're going to have to stand in his presence. And you're not going to be able to hide behind all the stuff you worked for. Yeah, you can send Leah out first. You can send Rachel out first. You can send your flocks out first. But what Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 13 tells us is that we're going to all stand in front of one who sees us naked and exposed. That's the one we have to give account to. And when all that other stuff is gone, God's going to see past it. He's not going to see what we've earned. We can't even hide behind our own works or our own righteousness or our own reason for boasting. It's just us and God. And when you look into the eyes of God, when you're in that moment, when you see God's face, you're going to know that it's grace. You're going to know that what you need more than anything else is pure, unmitigated grace from God, because that's the only thing that saved Jacob. When Jacob met Esau, Esau could have just ended it right there. He would have had the right to do that. But Esau asked about his children, and he forgave him, and it was just grace that saved Jacob. But so here's this thing.
if we're talking about grace and how to receive it, this grace can only be received by those who truly realize how desperately they need it. And I think that that is what was happening in that whole wrestling with the angel thing, or wrestling with God. What Jacob learned in wrestling with him is that he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And the truth is, God wrestles with all of us in life. Or really, maybe what we should say is that we wrestle with God. You know? God is constantly trying to change us and to form us and to teach us not to go this way but to go that way. And a lot of times we just want to resist. We want to fight back. You know, God could just crush us if he wanted to. You know, he could just like force us if he wanted to. He could just strike us down if he wanted to. But just like God held back when he wrestled Jacob, he holds back when he wrestles with us. I mean, he's so patient with us. And as he struggles with us and we struggle back with him, he's so patient about his efforts to change us. But sometimes, because we won't submit, what God has to do is he has to put a hip out. He has to disable us. He has to bring some kind of factor in where we realize just how dependent on him we are. And I think that this idea helps us make sense of suffering in our lives. I mean, why does cancer happen? Why do people lose their jobs? Why do people get sick? Why do bad things happen? Why do we lose friends? I don't have all the answers for that, but I know that we can thank God when that happens. Because if that's an opportunity for us to learn to rely on him, then that's a blessing to us. And what God taught Jacob in that moment, in that wrestling match, was that you're not strong enough to meet Esau on your own. You're out of options. You can't trick your way out of it now. And so as he wrestled with him, he showed him, the only thing you can do is hold on to me. And Jacob learned to say that I won't let you go unless you bless me. And Paul learned that same thing in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 about, you know, I'm blessed when I go through hardships and sufferings and all that kind of stuff, because when I'm weak, then I'm strong. That's when I learned to really trust God. And so the same thing that happens to us in physical hardships and physical problems like that happens to us on a deep and profound level when we're touched by the gospel. Just like Jacob left with a new limp and a new confidence in God, isn't that the way the gospel affects us? I mean, if we really get our minds around the message of the gospel, it's really two parts, right? It's number one, that you are so sinful and so wicked that the Son of God had to die for you. I mean, you realize that? Like, what is that? That's huge. Like, the Son of God had to die for me. That's the only hope that I had. But then, it's also, you're so loved and so desired that the Son of God died for you. And so it's like this new limp, and it's this new confidence that after we encounter the gospel, that we can move on from it in strength because of it. So let me just talk about the end of the story again. Because I think that there's a possible misunderstanding or a possible criticism that somebody might have by looking at this. And that is, you know, if we believe this, if we're in Jacob's position and we have to learn to just cling to God and trust not in our sheep or our things or our stuff, but it's only by God's grace, then if salvation is totally dependent on our reception of God's grace, then doesn't that mean that we won't obey him or we won't give him anything or we won't do what he says? And Paul had to answer questions like that too. In Romans, Paul talked about grace a lot, and people would say, like in chapter 6 and verse 1, they'd say, so should we keep sinning so that grace may abound? And Paul says,
Certainly not. The Greek word is very strong there. It's anathema. May it never be. I looked up the Message translation, and it says, surely not, or man, now I'm not going to be able to remember it on the spot, but it was a little stronger. But I like a more modern and pointed translation would probably be something like, don't be dumb. You know, it's like, if we've received grace, does that mean we can do whatever we want? No, don't be dumb. Don't think that. That's not what it's all about. In fact, if we really understand grace, it changes us. And let me show you that. Look in verse 8 one more time. Genesis 33 and verse 8. Esau said, what do you mean by all this company that I met? Jacob answered, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. Jacob said, no, please. If I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand. For I've seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you've accepted me. Please accept my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. Thus he urged him, and he took it. I'll tell you what, that's our relationship with God. That's the way that we stand with him. It reminds me a lot of what Paul said in Acts 17. When he was preaching to people, he made the point that we can't give God anything that he needs. God doesn't need anything from us. And that's where Jacob was with Esau. He realized that his presence couldn't earn his salvation from Esau. He realized that none of the stuff he could give him could force Esau to forgive him. And Esau wasn't even in a position where he needed it. But Jacob said, no, if by grace I've been saved, I just want to give you everything that I have. And that's what grace does. When we really get our minds around it and we really figure this out, that I can't give God anything to force him to save me, but the fact that he did, it changes the question from what do I have to give God to what can't I? How much can I give him? So the question is, what will we hold back from God? Not what do we have to give him, but what will we hold back? Jacob, if I counted right in this chapter, gives Esau something like 580 animals. Micah sort of ups the ante in his prophecy, and he says, shall I give the Lord 1,000 rams, 10,000 rivers of oil? It says, no, what God really wants is he wants me to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with him. And if our hearts are properly just set on fire by this, by appreciation of the grace that's been shown to us, we'll stop asking how much do we have to give God? How often do we have to come to church? How often do we have to encourage other people? How much do we need to pray? And it'll just be like, God, I just want to give you everything. I just want to give every step to you. I want to walk every moment with you. I want to give you everything that I have because I'm so indebted to the one who gave me everything. And so we can give it in confidence, and we can give it in gratitude, and we won't have to give it in fear of him. Now, the last thing I want to point out in this story, and then I'll be done, is that there's a reason for us to be able to give God everything we have in confidence of his grace. And I want to point you back to that strange night where Jacob wrestled with God. Because I don't think that Jacob only prefigured are wrestling with God, but there was something else that he was demonstrating. He was pointing to something else. Look in chapter 32 and verse 22. You notice that he sent his 11 children away from him. And then in verse 24, Jacob was left alone. And this happened in darkness. I mean, surely that rings some bells, right? Somebody who's had the 11 depart from him, who was alone in darkness. Jacob didn't just prefigure us wrestling with God, holding on in the dark, but Jacob prefigured the one who would suffer for us. But there's one significant difference.
is that the one who touched Jacob and held back crushed Jesus when he was on the cross. There was no holding back. Jesus drank the cup. And when the Father touched Jesus, he crushed him. And the other significant difference is that Jacob held on for a blessing for himself. Jesus became a curse so that the blessing could be for us. I hope that that's exciting to you. I mean, there's just so much in these stories that I just think we miss if we don't think about them. But the point that I want you to take away from all of this is that because Jesus went through that for us, we can have complete confidence in His grace. We can have complete confidence in the grace of God. We don't need to get into this business of working for Laban for however many years so that we can send this huge company before us to God. There's going to be a day where we stand before God and He's going to want to know, what is our basis for righteousness with Him? And it's not going to be any of that stuff. We're going to need His grace. And the way that you receive His grace is only through His Son, Jesus. And if you need to make your life right with Him, it's to confess your belief in Jesus as the Son of God, to be baptized for the remission of your sins, not as a work to earn your salvation, but just as a plea to God for a clean conscience. I've heard before it described like this, that there's a man who is drowning. He goes under the water a couple of times. He goes under the water a third time, and he's crying out for help. And finally, somebody throws him a rope. And he holds on really tight, and he pulls him out, and he's laying on the banks of the water, and he's just gasping for air, and he's panting. And, you know, you're looking at this guy, you're expecting him to just overflow with gratitude, and he says, "Man, did you see how tight I held on to that rope? It was awesome. I did that. I held on tight, and as much as the waters hit me, I just wasn't going to let go." Nobody would react like that. And all of us are drowning, and the invitation to accept the rope, to accept the grace, is to obey the gospel and make your life right with God. And so if there's anything that we can do to help you with that, we're going to sing this invitation song to encourage you. And I just, while I sing, I'm going to be praying. And while everybody else sings, I just want to encourage you, sing it like you mean it. Sing it like you're really inviting people to come. And if there's somebody out there who needs to respond to the invitation, we ask that you'd come to the front while we stand together and sing.